one reason, namely the fear of leaving someone hanging, that so many people text and drive. Indeed, the more you think about this, the more likely you are to come to the same conclusion as Tristan Harris. The closer we pay attention to the options we're given, he writes, the more we'll notice when they don't actually align with our true needs. We self-medicate. As we've talked about, the flip side of wanting to feel pleasure is the desire to avoid feeling bad, ideally with as little effort as possible. That's why, instead of getting to the root of our negative feelings, we turn to alcohol or drugs or our phones. In a 2017 article in the New York Times, Matt Richtel reported that there's been a decade-long trend toward less alcohol and drug use among teenagers. Great news. Unless kids are just replacing one possible addiction with another. The title of the article was, "Are Teenagers Replacing Drugs with Smartphones?" And the conclusion among most of the experts quoted was that the answer is likely yes. I see her at this point in time as not being a person who is controlled in any way by smoking pot, one school psychologist was quoted saying about his own daughter. But her phone is something she sleeps with. We fear our own minds. If our smartphones excel at one thing, it's making sure we never, ever have to be alone with ourselves. And thank goodness, in 2014, researchers from the University of Virginia and Harvard University published the results of a two-part study in Science that demonstrated the lengths we'll go to avoid our own minds. In the first experiment, volunteers received a mild electric shock and then were asked whether the experience was unpleasant enough that they would pay to avoid being shocked again. The researchers took the 42 people who'd said that they would pay to avoid another shock and left them alone in undecorated rooms without access to the internet or any other form of distraction and instructed them to entertain themselves with their thoughts for 15 minutes. They also told the participants that, if they wanted, they could press a button and receive another electric shock. As in, the same shock they'd just said they'd pay to not have repeated. You'd think that no one would have taken them up on the offer, right? Wrong. Out of the 42 participants, 18 chose to give themselves a shock during the 15-minute experiment. 18! And not just once. In what is undoubtedly my favorite detail of the study, one outlier shocked himself 190 times. What is striking, wrote the authors, is that simply being alone with their own thoughts for 15 minutes was apparently so aversive that it drove many participants to self-administer an electric shock that they had earlier said they would pay to avoid. Beware of geeks bearing gifts. Put this all together, and our phones are like digital Trojan horses. Innocuous-seeming accessories packed with manipulative tricks meant to get us to let down our guard. As soon as we do so, our attention is theirs for the taking. And as we'll see in a moment, it's a very valuable prize. Chapter 4. Why Social Media Sucks. Even more than it is in the advertising business, Facebook is in the surveillance business. Facebook, in fact, is the biggest surveillance-based enterprise in the history of mankind. It knows far, far more about you than the most intrusive government has ever known about its citizens. John Lancaster. When I ask people which category of apps they find the most problematic, social media is the most common response. Like junk food, the content of these apps is hard to stop consuming, even when you're aware that it's making you feel sick. It should make you feel sick. From its deliberately addictive design to its surveillance-based business model, social media represents the epitome of Trojan horse design. It's meant to manipulate us into doing and sharing things we otherwise would not, often with negative effects on our mental health and society at large. And once you understand the forces behind social media, you may begin to think differently about many of the other apps and features on your phone, too. Let's start with a question. Have you ever wondered why social media apps are all free? It's not because their creators are driven by a philanthropic urge to help the world share selfies. It's because we are not actually the customers, and the social media platform itself is not the product. Instead, the customers are advertisers, and the product being sold is our attention. Think about it. The more attention we devote to Facebook or Twitter or a dating app or other social media, the more chances there are for the program to show us a sponsored post. And the more information we voluntarily post, the more personalized, attention-stealing, and profitable, for the social media company, the sponsored posts and ads will be. In the words of Dopamine Labs founder Ramsey Brown, "You don't pay for Facebook. Advertisers pay for Facebook. You get to use it for free because your eyeballs are what's being sold there." As we touched upon earlier, the prize these advertisers are after is engagement, which is the metric by which companies evaluate the number of clicks, likes, shares, and comments associated with their content. Engagement is sometimes referred to as the currency of the attention economy, and advertisers are willing to spend a lot of money for it. Global ad spending on social media in 2016 was $31 billion, almost double what it was just 2 years before. In other words, every moment of attention we spend scrolling through social media is attention spent making money for someone else. The numbers are staggering. A New York Times analysis calculated that as of 2014, Facebook users were spending a collective 39,757 years worth of attention on the site, every single day. It's attention that we didn't spend on our families, or our friends, or ourselves. And just like time, once we've spent attention, we can never get it back. This is a really big deal, because our attention is the most valuable thing we have. We experience only what we pay attention to. We remember only what we pay attention to. When we decide what to pay attention to in the moment, we are making a broader decision about how we want to spend our lives. To be clear, there is nothing wrong with spending your attention on social media or on any other app. There is also nothing wrong with a designer trying to make an app that's fun, engaging, and profitable. But as users, we should be using our apps because we've made a conscious choice to do so, not because of manipulative psychological tricks that are meant to make money for someone else. Social media knows how to steal our attention. Once you're aware of the motives behind social media platforms, namely attention stealing and information gathering, you'll begin to notice how these motives are incorporated into their designs. As we've discussed, like buttons and comment features aren't just there to help us connect with other people. They're there because adding metrics to social interactions is a guaranteed way to keep us going back to see our score. Similarly, it would be easy for social media apps to be built with optional stopping cues to help us control our consumption. An app could give you the choice to see posts only from the last hour or day, or to set a limit for how much time you want to spend looking at your feed. But providing options like this might reduce engagement. So instead, the feeds are deliberately designed to be endless. And even though we know that we will never finish our feeds, we keep scrolling in pursuit of the dopamine hits that we get from every new post. How to unlike likes. If you find yourself obsessed with amassing likes, you may want to install a Facebook Demetricator browser plugin. It removes all the scores from Facebook so that instead of saying 57 people liked your post, it will simply say, "People like this." See if this makes a difference. Then ask yourself why Facebook itself doesn't provide this option. Social media is making us depressed. Perhaps one of the most disturbing aspects of social media is the effects that it is having on our real-life relationships with other people, and, as a consequence, on our mental health. Most people sign up for social media accounts out of a desire to feel connected. But numerous studies suggest that the more we use social media, the less happy we will be. In 2017, the American Journal of Epidemiology looked at the same group of people over time, hoping to determine whether social media use actually caused unhappiness, as opposed to simply appealing to people who are already unhappy. It concluded that there does indeed appear to be a causal relationship. As the authors described their results in the Harvard Business Review, "We found consistently that both liking others' content and clicking links significantly predicted a subsequent reduction in self-reported physical health, mental health, and life satisfaction." In an article in The Atlantic titled, disturbingly, "Have Smartphones Destroyed a Generation?" psychologist Jean Twenge presents compelling evidence that, as she puts it, "The arrival of the smartphone has radically changed every aspect of teenagers' lives, from the nature of their social interactions to their mental health." While teenagers are extreme examples of this, I would argue that smartphones are doing the same to the rest of us, too. The article includes charts representing various trends in teenage behaviors from 1976 to 2016. From time spent hanging out with friends to the age of getting driver's licenses, to dating, to sleep, to sex, to, most strikingly, loneliness, the charts all have one thing in common. The slope of their lines changes dramatically after 2007, the year the first iPhone was released. Look at this data together, and it's hard not to come to the same conclusion as Twenge. There is compelling evidence that the devices we've placed in young people's hands are having profound effects on their lives and making them seriously unhappy. As she puts it, today's teens may be physically safer than their predecessors, less likely to drive drunk, for example, but that is likely because they are on their phone, in their room, alone, and often distressed. Depression among teenagers is way up. Suicide rates are, too. Social media is Big Brother. Imagine that someone knocked on your door and asked you to register the following information with the government: your full name, birth date, phone number, email address, physical address, education and work history, relationship status, names and photographs of all family members and friends, photographs and videos of yourself for as far back in time as possible, your political leanings, your travel history, your favorite books, your favorite music, and your favorite, well, everything. Would you? On social media, we provide this information, and more, voluntarily, and with virtually no thought as to what the social media company might do with this information. As Antonio Garcia Martinez, former product manager at Facebook, writes in his memoir, Chaos Monkeys, "The biggest thing going on in marketing right now, what is generating tens of billions of dollars in investment and endless scheming inside the bowels of Facebook, Google, Amazon, and Apple, is how to tie different sets of information together, and who controls the links." The amount of information that Facebook has about its users is truly shocking. Garcia Martinez refers to Facebook as the regulator of the biggest accumulation of personal data since DNA. What most of us don't realize is that Facebook doesn't just know everything you do and share on Facebook. Thanks to Facebook buttons and cookies, small files left behind on your computer that make it possible for companies to track your activities across sites, Facebook also knows many of the websites you've visited, apps you've used, and links you've clicked on. And thanks to partnerships with external data collection companies such as Equifax, it knows countless details about your offline life too, including, but not limited to, your income and basically every purchase you've ever made with a card. Finally, there's one more important reason to be aware of the motivations behind social media: the effects all this targeting and personalization are having on society as a whole. For as creepy as it might be to think of a company controlling this much data about such an enormous number of people, the only purpose, from Facebook's perspective, is to make Facebook money. On the positive side, this means that Facebook is very protective of its data because it's valuable. But the negative side is that Facebook does not have any intrinsic reason to care about whether the content that it's helping its advertisers share with us is factually accurate. Instead, the goal is clicks. And when it comes to garnering clicks, the more sensational a post is, the better. When you put this together with Facebook's ability to target ads, in this example, in the form of fake news stories, to the people who are the most likely to click on and share them, we end up in a situation where the stories that show up in my newsfeed might be completely different from those that show up in your newsfeed, and where none of them have been vetted to make sure they reflect any version of reality. The more this happens, the more we risk creating a society in which we no longer have a shared definition of the truth. Chapter 5. The Truth About Multitasking. The mind cannot have two thoughts at once. See if you can think two thoughts at exactly the same time. Well, is it possible? Haman Sunim, The Things You Can See Only When You Slow Down, How to Be Calm and Mindful in a Fast-Paced World. One of the most common defenses of phones is the idea that they're making us better at multitasking and, in so doing, more efficient. Unfortunately, this isn't true. There's actually no such thing as multitasking. That is, simultaneously processing two or more attention-demanding tasks, because our brains can't do two cognitively demanding things at once. Yes, we can do the dishes while we listen to the news, but that's not multitasking in the true sense of the word, because one activity is not cognitively demanding. When we think we're multitasking, we're actually doing what researchers call task switching. Like cars making sharp turns, our brains need to slow down and switch gears every time we stop thinking about one thing and engage with another. A process that has been estimated to take 25 minutes every time you do it. And I'm not just talking about multitasking at work, though most of us probably intuitively know that checking email when we are in the middle of a difficult task does not help our productivity. I also mean all the mini multitasking that we engage in all day long, glancing at Twitter while we're also watching TV, looking at our email while we're on a call, even flipping quickly between apps as we wait in line to order lunch. You might think that you're able to simultaneously listen to your friend and respond to that text, but you can't. In fact, we're often shifting the focus of our attention so rapidly that we never give ourselves enough time to get in gear to begin with. When's the last time you spent 25 minutes just doing one thing? Not only is this making us unproductive, but it's also affecting our ability to think and problem solve. It's also mentally exhausting. And that's not all. In 2009, Stanford researchers led by Clifford Nass published a groundbreaking study in which they evaluated self-described heavy multitaskers' ability to perform a variety of tasks. The researchers hypothesized that while multitasking might be draining at first, over time, it must make people's brain better at something. They assumed that the heavy multitaskers in their study would be better than the controls at ignoring irrelevant information, switching efficiently between tasks, or organizing their memories. But according to Nass, the researchers were wrong. We were absolutely shocked. It turns out multitaskers are terrible at every aspect of multitasking. They're terrible at ignoring irrelevant information. They're terrible at keeping information in their head nicely and neatly organized. And they're terrible at switching from one task to another. Perhaps worse? One would think that if people were bad at multitasking, they would stop, said Nass. However, when we talk with the multitaskers, they seem to think they're great at it and seem totally unfazed and totally able to do more and more and more. Nass's conclusion? We worry that heavy multitasking may be creating people who are unable to think well and clearly. That itself is alarming, especially when you consider that multitasking, or at least trying to multitask, is exactly what our phones encourage us to do. Not to mention the fact that NASA's research was published only 2 years after the first generation iPhone was introduced. And it appears that, by weakening our attention spans and our memories, our phones are damaging our ability to single task too. Chapter 6. Your phone is changing your brain. Just as neurons that fire together wire together, neurons that don't fire together don't wire together. As the time we spend scanning web pages crowds out the time we spend reading books, the circuits that support those old intellectual functions and pursuits weaken and begin to break apart. Nicholas Carr, The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. The structure of our hearts and livers doesn't substantially change once those organs are formed. And until surprisingly recently, scientists believed that the physical structure of our brains and the function of individual neurons was similarly fixed. Then came the realization that our brains are constantly changing, and even more shockingly, that we have some control over the process. London cab drivers are one of the most famous examples of how, through thought and practice, we can change the structure and function of our brains. Aspiring London taxi drivers must memorize an astounding number of navigational details about the city, including the names and locations of roughly 25,000 streets, 320 common routes through the city, and the points of interest that exist within a half a mile of each of these routes. Before being allowed to drive a taxi, would-be cabbies must pass a test that's so comprehensive that it's simply known as the knowledge. And yes, they still have to do this, even now that we all have phones. In 2000, a team of researchers led by Eleanor Maguire at University College London published a study in which they scanned London cab drivers' brains to see how they compared to the brains of people who had not devoted months of their lives to memorizing the intricacies of the city. The researchers discovered that the area responsible for spatial memories, the posterior hippocampus, was larger in the cab drivers' brains than in the non-cabbies. The time they'd spent studying London's streets had had a physical impact. Their thoughts had changed their brains. What's more, the longer a person had been a cab driver, in other words, the more time they'd spent practicing, the more noticeable the change. Think about that for a second. And then think back to the fact that as of 2017, Americans were spending an estimated average of more than 4 hours a day on their phones. If you spend 4 hours a day doing anything, you're going to get pretty good at it. If I spent 4 hours a day practicing the piano, I'd be able to accomplish my long-standing goal of learning to sight-read music within a month. If I spent 4 hours a day studying Spanish, it wouldn't be long before I'd be able to have a basic conversation. Our brains, just like those of the London cab drivers, respond powerfully to repetition and practice. So it's well worth investigating what skills the hours we're spending on our phones each day might be training us to develop, and at what cost. Most of the hours we spend on our smartphones are not spent in concentrated thought. Instead, we're picking up our phones for minutes or seconds at a time. Even when we're on them for longer stretches, we're not engrossed in one activity. We're scrolling and swiping between screens. And even when we stay within one app, say a news app or social media, we're usually still not focusing on anything for more than a few moments. Every tweet, message, profile, and post pulls our brains in a different direction. We end up acting like water bugs, skittering on the surface without ever diving in. But that's not to say that we only casually focus our attention on our phones. On the contrary, they completely absorb us. The result is what seems like should be an oxymoron, an intensely focused state of distraction. As it turns out, this type of frequent, focused distraction isn't just capable of creating long-lasting changes in our brains. It is particularly good at doing so. In his 2010 book, The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains, journalist Nicholas Carr wrote that, "If you were to set out to invent a medium that would rewire our mental circuits as quickly and thoroughly as possible, you would probably end up designing something that looks and works a lot like the Internet." Today, I'd argue that we can take this even further. If you wanted to invent a device that could rewire our minds, if you wanted to create a society of people who were perpetually distracted, isolated, and overtired, if you wanted to weaken our memories and damage our capacity for focus and deep thought, if you wanted to reduce empathy, encourage self-absorption, and redraw the lines of social etiquette, you'd likely end up with a smartphone. Chapter 7. Your phone is killing your attention span. Multiscreening trains consumers to be less effective at filtering out distractions. They are increasingly hungry for something new. This means more opportunities to hijack attention. Consumer Insights, Microsoft Canada, 2015. The first thing to understand about our attention spans is that distraction is our default. Human beings are naturally distractible because in nature, things are often trying to kill us. We want our attention to be drawn to changes in our environments because those changes might indicate a threat. But why is staring at our phones so much more distracting and compelling than, say, scanning our surroundings for tigers? In The Distracted Mind, neuroscientist Adam Ghazali and psychologist Larry Rosen suggest that it's because our phones, and for that matter, the Internet, satisfy another evolutionary quirk, our desire for information. Human beings seem to exhibit an innate drive to forage for information in much the same way that other animals are driven to forage for food, write Ghazali and Rosen. This hunger is now fed to an extreme degree by modern technological advances that deliver highly accessible information. In other words, our brains both prefer and are programmed to seek out and be distracted by new information. And that's exactly what our phones encourage them to do. One of the reasons our brains prefer distraction to concentration is that concentration requires our brains to do two difficult things at once. The first is to choose what to pay attention to. That job falls to a part of the brain called the prefrontal cortex, which is responsible for so-called executive or top-down functions, such as decision-making and self-control. In many ways, the prefrontal cortex is what makes us human. If we didn't have control over our attention, we couldn't think abstract and complicated thoughts. But just like a muscle, the prefrontal cortex can become tired if we ask it to make too many decisions, a condition known as decision fatigue. When our prefrontal cortex becomes tired, our focus wavers and our minds wander. We lose our ability to distinguish between what's important to pay attention to and what's not. The more information we're presented with, the more of a problem this becomes. As a relatively new part of our brain, the prefrontal cortex is also one of the weakest. Under stressful conditions, it tends to freak out and hand the reins to more primitive areas of our brains, which is not a good thing considering that we often reach for our phones out of stress. The second task required for concentration doesn't get as much, well, attention. But it's just as important, if not more so. We need to be able to ignore distractions. Our brains are exposed to an onslaught of stimulation even without man-made distractions like phones, or interior distractions like thoughts. Sights, tastes, smells, sounds, textures, our senses are constantly presenting us with new information to act on and absorb. In a way, this makes our ability to ignore distractions even more impressive than our ability to pay attention. We can pay attention to really only one thing at a time, but there is an infinite amount of sensory information that doing so might require us to block. Unsurprisingly, ignoring distractions is tiring work, and the less we practice it, the worse at it we become. When our strength is exhausted and we can no longer block extraneous information, we lose our focus. We go back to our default state of distraction. If you've noticed that reading a book or printed newspaper doesn't feel the same as reading the same material on your phone or computer, you're not crazy. It's not the same. When we read a book or the paper, most of the distractions we encounter are external, a barking dog or the sound of a vacuum cleaner. This makes it relatively easy for our brains to decide what's important and to ignore what's not. This also leaves our brains with plenty of available bandwidth to think about and absorb what we're reading. When we read words in print, which is to say, without links or ads, we primarily activate the brain areas associated with absorbing and understanding information. But when we read on a phone or computer, links and ads are everywhere. For now, at least, most e-books are a glorious exception. From the point of view of our attention spans, this is problematic in at least three ways. First, every time we encounter a link, our brains must make a split-second decision about whether to click on it. These decisions are so frequent and tiny that we often don't even notice that they're happening. But we can't make split-second decisions and think deeply at the same time. The two acts use different and competing brain regions. Every decision, no matter how tiny or subconscious, pulls our attention away from what we are reading. This in turn makes it harder to absorb the content of what we're reading, let alone to think about it critically or remember it later. Second, unlike a dog barking in the background, online distractions are embedded in what we're trying to focus on. This makes it very difficult for our brains to distinguish between what to pay attention to and what to ignore. Trying to absorb the meaning of a word without noticing its link is like trying to count a dog's whiskers while the dog is licking your face. Nearly impossible, and almost definitely unpleasant. And third, when mental fatigue causes us to give in to our brain's natural preference for distraction, whether it's by falling for clickbait or swiping over to social media, we reinforce the same mental circuits that made it hard to sustain our focus to begin with. We get better at not staying focused. The result is that the more we read online, the more we teach our brains to skim. This can be a useful skill to hone, especially when we're constantly faced with such information overload. But it becomes a problem if skimming becomes our default. Because the better we become at skimming, the worse we get at reading and thinking more deeply. And the harder it is for us to focus on just one thing. Unfortunately, the worse our focus gets, the more valuable we become. Just as social media companies make money by stealing and then selling your attention, informational websites make money by distracting you. Even subscription-based sites, such as newspapers, depend on page views and click-throughs for revenue. That's why online articles contain so many links and why slideshows are so common. Focus isn't profitable. Distraction is. Chapter 8. Your phone messes with your memory. What you have discovered is a recipe not for memory, but for reminder. Plato, Phaedrus. Our brains have two primary forms of memory, short-term and long-term, and our phones affect both. Long-term memory is often described as being like a filing cabinet. According to this analogy, when you want to remember something, your brain does a quick search of its archives and retrieves that one specific memory from the folder in which it was stored, leaving the rest of the files untouched. But that's not how it works. When we store a long-term memory, it doesn't exist on its own in a manila folder in our brain. It exists in a network of other connected memories, called schemas. These networks help us make sense of the world by linking every piece of new information that we acquire to information that we already have. Schemas explain why a single stimulus, say the smell of a cake baking, can trigger a flurry of memories. Schemas also sharpen our thinking by helping us identify commonalities between seemingly disparate things. For example, our brains know that a traffic cone and a pumpkin have different purposes, and thus the two objects aren't connected schematically by function. But traffic cones and pumpkins do share a different trait. They're both orange. This means that they're schematically linked by color, both to each other and to other orange things, such as tangerines. As this example demonstrates, every piece of information can exist in multiple schemas at once. Tangerines are linked to the schema for the color orange, and thus share a connection with a traffic cone, and the schema for citrus fruit, thus sharing a connection with a lemon. The number of connections is itself important, because the more you're able to draw connections between seemingly unconnected things, the more likely you are to have insights. One thought triggers another thought, which triggers another, and suddenly, you've had a breakthrough. In short, the more nuanced and detailed your schemas are, the greater your capacity for complex thought. But schemas take time and mental space to build. When our brains are overloaded, our ability to create schemas suffers. And guess what overloads our brain? To understand why heavy phone use messes with our schemas, we need to talk about working memory, a term that's often used interchangeably with short-term memory. Broadly speaking, your working memory is everything you're holding in your mind at any given moment. It's the part of your mind that answers the question, "What was I just looking for?" when you walk into a room in search of your keys and get distracted along the way. Working memory, which can also be thought of as your consciousness, is also the gateway through which every long-term memory must pass. After all, you can't have a long-term memory of an experience unless you were conscious of it in the first place. Here's the first problem. Our working memory can't hold on to many things at once. A famous 1956 study on working memory was titled "The Magical Number 7, Plus or Minus 2," suggesting that we're able to hold between 5 and 9 items in our working memory. But more recent estimates put the capacity closer to 2 to 4. As a result of their limited capacities, our working memories are easily overloaded. If I introduce you to 2 people at a party, you probably will be able to remember their names. But if I introduce you to 8 people at once, you probably won't. Likewise, it'd be harder to remember your own phone number if it were presented as an uninterrupted string of digits instead of in 3 distinct chunks. Adding to the challenge, the more information your working memory is trying to handle, which is referred to as your cognitive load, the less likely you are to remember any of it. That's in part because it takes time and mental energy to transfer information from your working memory to your long-term memory. In fact, whereas short-term memories are generally created by strengthening the connection between neural circuits, creating long-term memories requires your brain to actually create new proteins. It also takes time and mental energy to connect each new piece of information to all the schemas of which it could be a part. If your brain is busy trying to hold too much information in its working memory, if its cognitive load is too great, it won't have the ability to store that information, let alone process it in a way that makes it useful or to create the proteins necessary to transfer the memory into long-term storage. It's like trying to organize your wallet while juggling. You can't. And that brings us to our phones. Everything about smartphones overloads our working memories. The apps, the emails, the news feeds, the headlines, even the home screen itself. A smartphone is a virtual avalanche of information. The result, short term, is mental fatigue and difficulty concentrating. The long-term consequences are even scarier. As we've talked about, when we train our attention on our phones, we miss out on everything else going on around us. And if you don't have an experience to begin with, then it goes without saying that you're not going to remember it later. What's more, when we overload our working memories, we make it harder for our brains to transfer new information to our long-term memories. This in turn makes it less likely that we'll remember the experiences and information that we did manage to pay attention to. Lastly, when our working memories are overloaded and our cognitive loads are too great, our brains don't have the resources necessary to connect new information and experiences to our pre-existing schemas. Not only does this reduce the likelihood of those memories becoming permanent, but the weaker our schemas become, the less likely we are to have insights and ideas. We lose our capacity for deep thought. Chapter 9. Stress, Sleep, and Satisfaction. In their quest for happiness, people mistake excitement of the mind for real happiness. Sayadaw Pandita, In This Very Life, The Liberation Teachings of the Buddha. In the past, if a person described herself as feeling happy, sad, excited, anxious, curious, frustrated, ignored, important, lonely, joyful, and existentially depressed within the space of 5 minutes, she likely would have received a diagnosis. But give me 5 minutes on my phone, and I can accomplish this and more. Our phones are like Pandora's boxes of emotions, and every time we check them, we open ourselves up to an unpleasant surprise. You could get an email that worries you, or a text message about something you forgot to do. Maybe there's a news story that makes you angry, or a stock price that makes you anxious, or a post that makes you sad. A lot of the time, you'll end up feeling stressed about something you truly cannot control, like politics or stock prices. But in a way, situations in which you could take back control, say by answering that stressful email right then and there, are even worse. In order to restore your sense of equilibrium, you have to remove yourself from whatever experience you had been having. In short, if ignorance is bliss, 'tis folly to look at your phone. Your phone and your sleep. Every night, 2 to 3 hours before your bedtime, a tiny gland in your brain begins to release a hormone called melatonin. Melatonin tells your body that it's nighttime and makes you sleepy. When daylight, which is a blue light, hits the back of your eyes in the morning, your brain stops producing melatonin. You feel awake and ready to start your day. When blue light fades and is replaced by darkness or the yellow glow of incandescent bulbs, melatonin begins to be released again. Guess what else radiates blue light? Screens. When we use our phones or tablets or computers before bed, their blue light tells our brains that it is daytime and that we should be awake. In other words, when we check our phones at night, we're giving ourselves jet lag. Screen time, particularly in the hour before bedtime, both keeps us up later and harms the quality of our sleep. But the quality of light is just one way that our phones affect our sleep cycles. Most of the things we do on our phones, reading the news, playing games, are stimulating activities. Imagine how difficult it would be to doze off if all of the people you follow on social media were in the room with you, the television was blaring in the background, and several friends were having a political debate. That's essentially what you're doing when you bring your phone into bed with you. Phones' effects on sleep are particularly concerning when you consider the health consequences of chronic fatigue, which include increased risk of obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and even early death. Indeed, according to the Division of Sleep Medicine at Harvard Medical School, even short-term sleep deprivation can affect judgment, mood, ability to learn and retain information, and may increase the risk of serious accidents and injury. When you're tired, it's harder for your brain to filter out distractions. You have poorer self-control. You're less able to tolerate frustration. And your brain has difficulty deciding what's important to pay attention to and what's not. And short-term sleep deprivation doesn't require you to have one crazy night. Even just a week and a half's worth of sleeping 6 hours a night instead of 7 to 9 can, according to the Division of Sleep Medicine, result in the same level of impairment on the 10th day as being awake for the previous 24 hours straight. Which is to say that it can induce impairments in performance equivalent to those induced by a blood alcohol level of 0.10%, beyond the legal limit for alcohol intoxication in the United States. Oh, and if you're thinking that this obviously does not apply to you, keep in mind that the more sleep-deprived people are, the more vigorously they may insist that they are not, possibly because their ability to judge their own mental state has been impaired. Your phone and flow. Flow is a term coined by the psychologist Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi to describe the feeling you get when you're completely and totally engaged in an experience. People can experience flow when they're singing, playing sports, or even working. When you're in flow, you're so present in the moment that you feel as if you're outside of time. The line between your experience and your mind gets erased. You're unself-conscious. You're entirely absorbed. You're in the zone. Flow leads to the sorts of moments and memories that make life seem rich. If you're distracted, you can't immerse yourself in an experience, which means that you can't, by definition, get into flow. And since our phones are tools of distraction, this means that the more we spend on our phones, the less likely we are to experience it. Your phone and creativity. Creativity, that is, the process of coming up with new ideas, also requires relaxation and mental space, both of which are hard to come by when we're on our phones. Creativity requires you to be well-rested. As Judith Owens, director of sleep medicine at Children's National Medical Center in Washington, D.C., has said, sleep deprivation can affect memory, creativity, verbal creativity, and even things like judgment and motivation. And creativity is often sparked by boredom, which is another mental state that our phones are great at helping us avoid. To me, the importance of boredom to creativity is summed up by this quote from Lin-Manuel Miranda, the award-winning, crazy talented genius behind Hamilton, an American musical. I remember when I was a kid, I was in a 3-hour car ride with my best friend Danny, Miranda told an interviewer for GQ. Before we got in the car, he grabbed a stick from his front yard, and the entire drive home he made up games with this stick. Sometimes the stick was a man, sometimes a piece in a larger game, or he'd give it voices, pretend the stick was a telephone. I remember sitting there next to him with my Donkey Kong thinking, dude, you just entertained yourself for 3 hours with a effing twig. And I thought to myself, wow, I have to raise my imagination game. When I read this, part of me thinks that I should be spending more time playing with sticks. And another, more cynical part of me thinks, I bet someone is going to make an app for that. Chapter 10. How to Take Back Your Life. We learn to stay with the uneasiness, the tightening, the itch of our cravings. We train in sitting still with our desire to scratch. This is how we learn to stop the chain reaction of habitual patterns that otherwise will rule our lives. Pema Chodron. So here's the good news. we can undo many of our phone's negative effects. We can rebuild our attention spans. We can get our focus back. We can reduce our stress, improve our memories, and reclaim a good night's sleep. We can change our relationships with our phones and take back our lives from our devices. That's what the next part of the book, The Breakup, is designed to help you do. Before we move on, though, let's talk a bit about the science and philosophy behind the breakup's steps. Mindfulness. Mindfulness is a complicated word to define, but for our purposes, I like the definition put forth by Judson Brewer, Director of Research at the Center for Mindfulness in Medicine, Healthcare, and Society at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. Mindfulness is about seeing the world more clearly, including ourselves. This simple idea is actually quite powerful, especially when it comes to breaking addictions. How powerful? In 2011, Brewer and his colleagues published the results of a randomized, controlled trial designed to test whether mindfulness training could help people stop smoking. More specifically, they wanted to compare mindfulness to the accepted gold standard treatment, the American Lung Association's Freedom from Smoking program. Over the course of 2 years, Brewer randomized nearly 100 smokers into two groups. One group was assigned to participate in the Freedom from Smoking treatment. The other group was trained in mindfulness. First, Brewer taught the mindful smokers about habit loops. They learned to identify their triggers and practiced paying attention to their cravings and reactions without trying to change anything. This step alone was surprisingly effective. Just paying conscious attention to the taste of cigarettes, for example, was enough to give one longtime smoker the resolve to finally quit. She moved from wisdom to knowledge, writes Brewer, from knowing in her head that smoking was bad to knowing it in her bones. Next, he taught them to turn toward their cravings rather than to run away. Participants practiced recognizing their cravings and relaxing into them, that is, allowing them to happen without trying to stop them. They practiced paying attention to how their cravings made them emotionally and physically feel, and they used this practice as a way to ride out their cravings when they occurred. Brewer also taught participants formal meditation exercises that they were expected to do each day. When Brewer's data were analyzed, it turned out that the people who had received the mindfulness training had quit at twice the rate of the Freedom from Smoking group. What's more, far fewer people from the mindfulness group relapsed. Practicing mindfulness can be just as effective, if not more so, when it comes to breaking our addictions to our phones. But that's not all it can do. Paying deliberate attention to your moment-to-moment experience also gives you more fodder for memories that don't involve your phone. It helps you deal with anxiety. It adds richness to your life. And that's why practicing this form of mindfulness is one of the first things that we're going to learn how to do. We'll start by paying deliberate attention to our emotions, thoughts, and reactions without judging ourselves or trying to change anything. We'll notice the invitations that our minds are sending us. And then we'll practice deciding how and if we want to respond. Let me take a second to elaborate. Like overzealous and slightly deranged party planners, our minds are constantly presenting us with invitations to do certain things or to react in certain ways. You hit a traffic jam and your mind invites you to give a fellow motorist the finger. You find yourself alone on a Friday night and your mind invites you to conclude that you are worthless and you have no friends. In other words, what we think of as irresistible impulses are actually invitations being sent by our minds. This is an important insight, because once you recognize this, you can ask your mind why it's inviting you to such crappy parties. Why couldn't a traffic jam be an invitation to a mobile karaoke session? Why couldn't a solitary Friday night be an invitation to watch a movie that you can't convince anyone else to see? not only does mindfulness help us get better at noticing and managing our invitations, but it also enables us to recognize the core emotions, fears, and desires that are driving our addictions, which is an essential step in breaking them. As Brewer explains in The Craving Mind, most addictions stem from a desire to feel better and/or to make a bad feeling go away. If you try to cut back on your phone use without first figuring out what you're trying to achieve or avoid, you're dooming yourself to failure. Either you're going to relapse, or you're going to find another, potentially more destructive habit that achieves the same effect. The more you practice being mindful, the more it becomes obvious that your brain has a mind of its own. I like to think of my mind as a good friend who also happens to be totally crazy. The moment you recognize that you don't have to say yes to every invitation is the moment you gain control over your life, both on and off your phone. How to ride out your phone cravings. The same approach that worked so well for the smokers also works for our phones. If we simply acknowledge our discomfort without trying to fight against it, in other words, if we ride out the wave, our cravings will eventually fade on their own. For example, let's say you catch yourself reaching for your phone. Practicing mindfulness means that instead of trying to fight your urge or criticizing yourself for having it, you simply notice the urge and stay present with it as it unfolds. As it does, you can ask questions about it. What does the craving feel like in your brain and in your body? Why are you having this particular urge right now? What reward are you hoping to receive, or what discomfort are you trying to avoid? What would happen if you reacted to the impulse? What would happen if you did nothing at all? The next time you find yourself tempted to look at your phone, pause instead. Take a breath and just notice the craving. Don't give in to it, but don't try to make it go away. Observe it. See what happens. We must act individually and collectively to make our attention our own again, and so reclaim ownership of the very experience of living. Tim Wu, The Attention Merchants. Part 2. The Breakup. Week 1. Technology Triage. Everyone knows what attention is. It is the taking possession by the mind, in clear and vivid form, of one out of what seems several simultaneously possible objects of trains of thought. It implies withdrawal from some things in order to deal effectively with others, and is a condition which has a real opposite in the confused, dazed, scatterbrained state. William James, The Principles of Psychology. Welcome to The Breakup, your hands-on guide to creating a new relationship with your phone. Here are some notes before we begin. You can personalize the plan. I have structured The Breakup as a 30-day guided plan, and I do recommend spreading it out because it takes time to change habits. That said, you should feel free to use this guide any way you want. The whole point is for the experience and your new relationship to be personalized. You are not alone. The quotes are from other people who have already gone through the breakup. I'm including them both as a source of inspiration and as proof that we're all struggling with similar things. There is no judgment in this breakup. Not by you, and certainly not by me. Our job is simply to observe, to ask questions, and to experiment. If you conclude that sending 150 WhatsApp messages a day is how you want to be spending your time, that is entirely your call. There is no need to stress, and there's no way to fail. If you try an exercise and it works for you, great. Add it to your toolkit. If an exercise doesn't work for you, then just move on to the next one. Likewise, if you slip back into an old habit, which, let's be honest, is likely to happen, don't beat yourself up. Instead, just get back on track. One way to do this is to simply acknowledge that you're disappointed, and then do something to offset the behavior you feel bad about and to regain momentum. Kind of like a carbon offset, but with your phone.